Welcome to the This Week in Rays Baseball podcast.
Coming up today, you'll hear from Matt Silverman on the Ben Zobrist trade and the Yuzdrubal Cabrera signing as well. We'll also chat with Mark Topkin about these topics, plus the Hall of Fame vote and much more.
This is Rays Radio. Now here's your host, Neil Solons.
Thanks for joining us on this Monday, January 12th. I hope your start of the new year has gone well as we get to our first podcast in 2015. Right now,
it's time to go inside the operating room and take a look at Rays baseball operations.
We continue on our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast, and it certainly has been a very busy first few months in his new role for the president of baseball operations, Matt Silverman. Matt, welcome back, and let's start with the news that was announced on Saturday. You've had a weekend since Ben Zobrist has officially been announced that he was traded. Has it set in for you?
I don't know if it's going to set in. Ben has been such a mainstay in our organization for so long that we'll always think of him as a Ray. And we've seen a number of players move on to other uniforms, and this one is probably the most painful to know that Ben's not going to be wearing a Rays uniform when we get to camp. It's an unfortunate reality of our organization and how we operate. And, you know, the irony of Ben is that we acquired him in this type of a trade where we traded Aubrey Huff near the end of his control and were able to get back Mitch Talbot and Ben Zobrist, the second piece in that deal. These are the types of deals that we make. We don't make them with a smile on our face at all, but we do it knowing that we're going to make ourselves better for the long run, and that's really an important thing for us to do.
How hard was the conversation with him, and is there anything you care to share with our fans about what that conversation was like? Because I'm sure that's something that's very, very difficult, especially for someone who spent a decade in the organization.
Yeah, I know a number of our players, but I probably know Ben the best out of all the guys down there, just given all of our time together. And so, in fact, it was a more comfortable conversation because it was a back and forth. But I sent him a text message in advance and just said, I'm going to call you soon with the call I didn't want to make. And hopefully it helped prepare him a little bit for the fact that I was calling about the trade. Ben reacted as you would expect Ben to. It was all about his gratitude to the organization and to the fans of Tampa Bay for what they've done for him and his family. And that his heart is with Tampa Bay. I mean, he couldn't have been more honest. He couldn't have been more forthcoming and appreciative of everything that's happened. And I echoed all of that. He's excited about the opportunity ahead of him, but he said his heart's going to be here in Tampa Bay for a long time.
Is there a story, since you had, as you mentioned, such a good relationship with Ben, that you can relate that epitomizes what he meant to this organization, what he's all about?
Just the story of Ben Zobrist is really the story of this organization over the last 8 years. He came here as an unheralded player who worked really hard and got everything out of his potential to become an all-star player and someone who is one of the most valuable players in baseball. He went from a Devil Ray to a Ray, and he's one of those few guys in our organization who knows what it's like to be a Devil Ray, to see the blossoming of this franchise into the Rays and all the success that we've had, and it's all linked to Ben Zobrist in his time here. So he is one of those figures, along with Evan Longoria and only a couple of other guys, who represent the transformation of this organization, and in a way his contributions will live on in this organization with the players that we got back and getting Jaso back here too.
Let's break down the trade then. Break it down from your standpoint. Where does it help and hurt the Rays in the short and the long term?
It's certainly a step back at the major league level to lose both of our middle infielders. But I look at this transaction done in concert with signing Yuzdrubal Cabrera. And here we have an all-star shortstop who steps in to fill part of that void. And the transactions are linked in that way. At the same time, we're able to get John Jaso back, and it's the type of left-handed bat our lineup can really use. And, we certainly needed the help on the offensive side, and he's someone that we can pencil into our lineup against right-handed pitching and know that we have a formidable bat. You know, the two prospects that we got back are prospects. And sometimes these guys turn into really valuable players, and we need that to happen. Our system wasn't as rich and as deep as we wanted it to be heading into this offseason. We've been able to replenish it, and Robertson is going to be one of the top guys, if not the top guys in our system. Whether he stays at shortstop, we don't know, but he's someone we think can be an impact bat, and someone given the time to develop can be a really valuable player. Boog Powell plays the game hard, plays the game well, is an exciting outfielder who has room to develop and is someone who we're excited to put into our organization and see what he can do. These are the types of transactions that we've been able to take advantage of, and you know, we see these guys, without going into too much detail, we make the Matt Garza trade, we get back a number of players, Chris Archer is in there. And we now have Chris Archer as a mainstay in our rotation. So our fans have unfortunately grown accustomed to this, but they understand this is the way we do business. And when we're competitive year in and year out, that's the reward.
You mentioned replenishing the farm system, and there's something that stuck out to me when you had or when you took on the job in our first conversation. And you talked about the importance of being bold and being willing to take chances and be opportunistic. And that's something you learned from Andrew. You certainly have been bold, and I look at eight players that you've now acquired since the end of the season in your minor league system. How much better do you think your minor league system is now than when you took over?
Yeah, on paper, our system is much better. It's much deeper and is much more talented. We'll get to see these guys play this year and see what we really have, but the early returns are very positive. I got to see a couple of these guys at the Winter Development Program, and they're excited to be Rays, and they come as advertised with their athleticism and their love of this game. Our system was in need of that replenishment, and we were able to take advantage of some opportunities to get some high ceiling players into the system. We already had a deep system, but we didn't have some of those standout prospects, and now we have a few of those to add to the depth. And with large numbers, we're going to have some good surprises, and we're going to see guys like Kiermaier bust onto the stage, and we need that in order to maintain our competitiveness.
You also mentioned the importance of improving the offense. How far along are you in that? Are you done yet? Do you still think there's more to be done before you break for camp?
There's always more to be done, but I think it would mostly be on the margins. If our hitters hit the way we believe they can, we're going to be a good enough offensive club, especially with the defense and the pitching that we have. There are a number of wild cards, but we're always going to have wild cards with the way we construct our roster, but a lot of upside, and that's what you want. You want to know that you have a certain level of productivity, but you want to give yourself upside to the positive, and that's what we see in a lot of the players that are returning, a lot of the new players that we have. Our goal is to have a balanced lineup and to make sure that 1 through 9 is a challenge as opposed to maybe 1 through 6 being a challenge and then 7, 8, 9 being a little bit of a black hole. That it's something that really hurts the offense. It hurts the momentum of innings, and we feel like we're a much more balanced offense 1 through 9.
Again, we're chatting with Matt Silverman on our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast. You mentioned also that you did chat with the prospects. What was the message you tried to send to them?
A number of messages, and Alex Cobb and Chris Archer can say it better than I can because they've lived the path of these prospects. But it was about professionalism. It was about respect for the process of development, to understand that we have their best interests in mind, and they may not agree with the way we develop or our patience, but that patience has paid off in players like Chris Archer and Alex Cobb, and that we, more than almost any organization in baseball, rely upon these prospects and young players for productivity. They're going to get their opportunities. If they develop, if they hone their craft, they're going to get their opportunities to be major league players here more than anywhere else. And that's why this program is so important. It helps us invest in them, let them know how serious we are about them, and lets them know the challenge ahead of, for themselves.
And in the meantime, you've got a couple of guys who you brought essentially on one-year deals, is Drubal Cabrera on the free agent deal, and John Jaso has 1 year before he's eligible technically for free agency. In John's case, do you carry three catchers since he's had the issues that he's had with concussions? Is he more a DH than anything? And in Cabrera's case, is he a shortstop, a second baseman, or you're not sure?
We're going to sort out a lot of this as we go into spring training and see these guys play. We know Cabrera can play shortstop. We know Franklin can play shortstop. And we have several other middle infielders who will be in the mix. How the playing time gets divvied up is to be seen, but we feel comfortable with both of those guys being able to play both short and second base. With Jaso, we look at him as a hitter. The fact that he can catch is a bonus, but that's not the reason why we acquired him. It was for the offensive side of his game. My expectation is that we will carry three catchers, and John would be the third catcher. But, again, nothing is written in stone, and we have a lot of time between now and opening day to figure that out.
And I'm sure plenty more to talk about between now and then. We appreciate a few minutes on our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast.
All right, thanks, Neil. Talk to you guys soon.
That's Rays Baseball Operations President Matt Silverman on a segment we like to call Inside the Operating Room, detailing the Ben Zobrist trade and the signing of Asdrubal Cabrera to a one-year contract.
Time now to head up to the press box.
We continue on our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast, and obviously a very busy week end for the Rays with Ben Zobrist, Yunel Escobar traded, the Asdrubal Cabrera signing official, a guy who technically is on vacation, but I have a feeling he has kept a close tabs on things as Mark Topkin of the Tampa Bay Times. Mark, thanks very much for being with us.
Anytime, Neil. And that, you're right. It absolutely was a busy weekend for the Rays.
And I assume that you were sort of on vacation, but not really.
Yeah, I was advising and helping out with our coverage a little bit and providing a little bit of a conduit there. I mean, it was, you know, one of those things where you'd heard, as we all had, the rumors that something might happen over the weekend. So certainly didn't spend the day with the umbrella drink out by the beach or anything like that.
What was your take on all of this? I mean, let's start first with in your mind, Ben's meaning to the organization and the difficulty in replacing him in some way, shape, or form, be it through a combination of players or just over time and his value.
Well, yeah, and I think others have said this as well, but I think you could make a case that Ben Zobrist may have been the most valuable player since the transformation to the Rays, and not the most talented, and not the most accomplished, and certainly not the highest paid, and not the most nationally known, but the most valuable player. And as Matt Silverman said in some of his comments, I mean, Ben Zobrist kind of typified Rays baseball as they made that transformation. You talk about a selfless guy, a guy who could help a team win in a number of different ways, a guy who could play multi-positions, which allowed the Rays, you know, as we talked about, when they're successful, they're playing with a 27- or 28-man roster in those 25 bodies. A guy who wasn't highly paid. He never, you know, talked about wanting to be the highest-paid player or anything like that. There was never any contract issues with Ben Zobrist. He took an under-market deal happily for the security of, you know, knowing he'd stay with the Rays at least, you know, for a long period of time, obviously not forever. So I think Ben Zobrist's value to the Rays in what he did, how he played the game, how he carried himself, the leadership he provided, in all those ways, he was arguably the most valuable player during that period of success.
How hard then is he to be able to replace?
Well, and you know, it's a cliche answer, but you can't replace Ben Zobrist. You're not going to find someone else, I don't think, just like him. And you know, adding to that is, you know, as Matt, you know, pointed out, the irony is he was acquired in a similar type trade, but he was unheralded. When the Rays traded Aubrey Huff to the Astros, you know, and there was some money involved and they got back a couple prospects, I think they probably thought the other prospect, Mitch Talbot, was going to be the better player at that point. Ben Zobrist was a minor league guy who hadn't really shown all that much. So to develop what he turned into, and, you know, the way they're going to replace Ben Zobrist is they're going to find, you know, other players who can try to fill that model. They, you know, Joe Maddon and the Rays created this Ben Zobrist model. You see other teams now trying to replicate that. You look all around baseball, other teams are trying to find that guy who can play a couple positions in the infield as well as the outfield. The fact that Ben Zobrist was a switch hitter, the fact that he could hit for power, that he would drop down a bunt, that he would take a walk, obviously the on-base percentage being one of his most outstanding statistics. So there's so many things that he did. He played almost every day and rarely hurt, you know, just, you know, never asked for a day off. There are just so many things about him that it's hard to replace him in any one guy.
And obviously, you know, there are guys who will, I guess, carry on the Ben Zobrist legacy within the organization in terms of the fact that they are guys who play multiple positions, and I'm sure you'll be covering plenty of them in spring training. What was your take on the whole trade overall and the signing of Asdrubal Cabrera then?
Well, you know, I think there's a couple ways to look at it. I think, you know, certainly some people will look at it and say that Rays didn't seem to get enough back. And in terms of, you know, major league quality players, major league ready players, when you give up two starting players and you get back one guy who probably, in John Jaso, is most of his playing time, it sounds like, is going to be a DH.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think people who, you know, are sophisticated in appreciating the value of prospects will know what the Rays got in Daniel Robertson and the value that he could have as a potential impact player starting shortstop and sometime, you know, arriving in the next couple of years, maybe by the end of 2016, the start of 2017. So, you know, that to me is the part that, you know, there's a little bit of a disconnect maybe with how fans appreciate the trade and how people in the industry appreciate the trade. You know, Boog Powell is a younger prospect, an outfielder, may or may not be a big league player. You know, what John Jaso can do in the short term. But I think really, ultimately, the success of this deal will be judged on what Daniel Robertson does. And in a way, I think there's some addition by subtraction. I mean, you know, Escobar was a very, very good player for the Rays in 2013, but he was not a very good player for the Rays in 2014. And with the salary that he was owed in 2015 and 2016, I think the Rays probably are better off without him and with that salary flexibility.
And you hit on my next subject, which was kind of getting underneath some contracts. I mean, they've moved the Yunel Escobar contract. They've moved the Ryan Hannigan contract, which after a year didn't look as good. Do they move David DeJesus' contract next?
Yeah, that would be another guy. I think, you know, if you were going to look at, if there were to be some more trades and you were going to look at who might be the next candidates to go under, you know, what seems to be a little bit of a model that we're seeing from Matt Silverman here and never, not that the Rays ever have hard and fast rules, but I think we're just getting a little bit of a sense here. You know, either James Loney or David DeJesus, two guys that the Rays do have some future obligations to, and neither guy had a very successful season last year. DeJesus more so with the injuries. Loney just kind of a step back from what he did the previous season. So, you know, I would think they'd still be looking a little bit to make a few more moves. I know Matt Silverman mentioned the possibility of bringing in another middle infielder and not being set yet with how they're going to line that up, whether Cabrera plays second or short and who the other partner is in that. I think Nick Franklin's the leading guy. But, you know, I think you may see a little bit more movement. I don't think you're going to see any movement among the starting pitchers. That seems to be, you know, kind of the sacred cow area here, and certainly the reason that the Rays still feel optimistic they can be a contending team when this all settles down. So, you know, if you see them move another position player and get a little bit more flexible, a little bit more younger, I think that fits in with the theme. If you saw them move a starting pitcher or two, that I'd be surprised. I think that would signal a further change in direction.
Good insight on that end. I know that you've talked a lot in the last week about your Hall of Fame vote, and your outline or your column was very interesting in terms of the way you went about it. What was your take on what occurred and the four that got into the Hall of Fame?
Well, I felt good in that I actually voted for all four guys that got in, which doesn't always happen, and not that this isn't, you know, it's not like getting an A in school or anything, but, you know, you put a lot of thought into this, and you know, some people don't care what the other people vote, but, you know, I like to see how what I decided matches up with what other people did and what their thought process was compared to mine. So I think those four guys were deserving. I know some people have, you know, kind of torn apart Biggio's career and said if you strip away the 3,000 hit label, it wasn't that good of a career, things like that. But I think Craig Biggio is a deserving Hall of Famer. You know, I think the pitchers obviously were. You know, there's one interesting debate that came in, as Neil, was with the pitchers that went in last year and then with the pitchers going in this year, does this make it easier for Mussina and Schilling to gain some traction and perhaps accelerate their ascension? Or does there become a little bit of, you know, to put a label on it, pitcher burnout among the voters? And does this hurt Mussina and Schilling making up further ground? So that's one thing. I think another thing you could take out of this, or at least a conversation point, is if Piazza is getting closer, and if Piazza gets in, does that kind of signal a little bit of a thaw on the performance-enhancing drug issue? I mean, not that he's ever been linked to it formally, but he's certainly a guy there's been a lot of conversation about. You've seen some voters come out and say, because of rumors, because of suspicions, they haven't voted for him. You know, if he were to get in next year, does that help the cause of the guys like Bonds and Clemens, who certainly have been linked to it in various ways, but again, have never, you know, tested positive, were never suspended by Major League Baseball for it? You know, they're guys I have voted for, they're guys that have not come close yet, and they're guys that, you know, quite frankly, are two of the best players of this entire era.
Do you think it would help? Obviously, you've outlined the how and why of your voting, but would it help to have some sort of direction on the PED era for all the voters so you're all, I guess, maybe not thinking uniformly, but at least have some further details on how to judge that era?
I think it would. I mean, I think you would initially have some people say, I don't need your help, thank you. But I think if Major League Baseball, or even more so if the Hall of Fame, you know, president of the Hall of Fame board came out and provided some direction, I think, you know, one question people have is, you know, they don't want to put these guys in and just have them look as if nothing was wrong. And I know one thing that a number of us writers have kicked around is, that's fine. Put a notation on their plaque. Add a couple lines. You know, those plaques are usually the same size and the same amount of words. Add a couple lines that say, you know, most of their career was played during what was considered baseball steroids era. You know, so-and-so, there were some questions about him. He was never suspended. I mean, whatever phrasing you need to put, but, you know, not to create a steroids wing, but to create a notation. That idea of the Hall of Fame, and maybe I'm being naive and simplistic here, the idea of the Hall of Fame is a museum to reflect the history of baseball. And if this era of baseball included a massive amount of players, and we don't know who and we don't know what degree, but a massive amount of players using some types of performance-enhancing drugs, I don't see how the players who excelled during that period should be ignored from Hall of Fame. That is part of baseball history.
They made a modification last year to go to kind of a 10-year system in terms of how many years you're on the ballot. Do you think that the next thing that gets done is to give that further direction, or do you think there are any changes next year regarding the way people vote or the direction they're given?
Well, there's a couple things in play here. One is, as you just mentioned, you know, whether there'll be some type of direction, and quite frankly, I don't think there will be, because a number of the Hall of Famers, the older players that are in the Hall of Fame, you know, you'll read every once in a while anonymous comments. They usually don't want to put their name to it, but there's usually some veiled comments that they don't want these guys in. And the Hall of Fame directors, you know, their success comes from getting the Hall of Famers to come back to their events and things like that. So I think there may be a little bit of a rift there in that the Hall of Fame doesn't want to anger the current Hall of Famers. The current Hall of Famers don't want the players in. The other issue that's in play right now is the Baseball Writers Association. We have asked the Hall of Fame to expand the voting limit from 10 to 12 on the ballots. And 12 isn't really a magic number or a great answer, but it was just an attempt by our group to try to, you know, push them along a little bit toward progress. There's some thought among the baseball writers, and this would certainly be a topic you and I, I'm sure, will talk about at some point this season, you know, to go to what would be called a binary ballot, where it was just yes or no. And stop, in other words, take away from the baseball writers. We've been put in a position where there's so many good candidates now stacked up or backlogged, where we have to rank them. You know, you have to do your ballot. I had to do this. I did my ballot, and I figured out my first eight, pretty easily, and then I was left three names for those last two spots, and I spent probably as much time or close to it agonizing over that as the first eight that I came to. So take us out of having to rank them and let us just decide, is a player a Hall of Famer or not? Is Dave Wills a Hall of Famer or not? Is Andy Freed a Hall of Famer or not? Is Neil Stallings? Well, we know Neil is, but in other words, I don't want to have to play one against the other. Let me just give you the answer to what you're really asking me, is this guy a Hall of Famer or not?
Good stuff as usual, Mark. I appreciate the only Hall of Fame vote I'll ever get. And and we'll be seeing you on the beat, I'm sure, this week at the Winter Development Program.
Sounds good, Neil. Anytime.
That's Mark Topkin on a busy Rays weekend off the field and Mark's Hall of Fame vote in a segment we like to call From the Press Box. We've got plenty going on over the next month regarding the roster for the Rays, but there's also a big event coming up at Tropicana Field at the end of January.
Time to check out the Community Corner and see what the Rays are doing in the community.
Joining us now on our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast is Dave McCarthy, Executive Director of the Ted Williams Hitters Hall of Fame. And I know that while the Major League Baseball announced their Hall of Fame class, you've got a big dinner coming up the end of this month where you'll induct your latest class into Hitters Hall of Fame, a dinner with Alex and friends.
We're excited about it, and of course, having Alex and a lot of the staff from the Rays here always makes it extra special. This year, our class of 2015 includes some great baseball names. We have Jim Thome, the great home run hitter, over 600 home runs. We have, of course, Thurman Munson, a legend in New York Yankee history, who died tragically in a plane crash, one of the greats of the game. Gene Michael, former manager and general manager of the New York Yankees and a great player himself at shortstop for many, many years, well-known throughout baseball. He's receiving the Lifetime Achievement Award. And then one of the fan favorites, a lot of people remember him from the Montreal Expos, also won a World Series with the Yankees, the great Tim Raines, who, by the way, just missed going into Cooperstown this year, and we're hoping that next year we'll see him reach that plateau.
Well, you recently had Craig Biggio, and maybe you're a good luck charm for him, so you can be the same for Tim Raines.
You know, a lot of guys are telling me that. Craig got in after being inducted here last year. Bert Blyleven got in the next year after being inducted here. Robbie Alomar came here and was inducted the following year. So we've got a pretty good track record of picking people, really, that should be in the Hall of Fame. And we're just thrilled to be able to honor him here with the Ted Williams Hitters Hall of Fame, which I think most people know, but the Ted Williams Museum and Hitters Hall of Fame is not just about Ted Williams. It's about all the great players in baseball. And we have over 105 players inducted currently.
And you've got, obviously, a wonderful museum, but the event you have on January 31st, a Saturday, is really a premier event in this area for people who are looking forward to the baseball season. Tell our fans a little bit about it and how they can get involved.
It's the best-kept secret in baseball, I think, sometimes. We have dinner on the field, so you buy a ticket to come to the dinner. You can get it on the Rays website, or you can get it through us at tedwilliamsmuseum.com. We have about 1,000 people that usually attend every year. This event has not only the people being inducted, but we bring in an additional 15 or 20 former great ball players, and they sign autographs for about an hour and a half free for all the attendees, so everybody gets a chance. And people like Doc Gooden, Wade Boggs, Louis Tiant, these are just some of the names, Alex Cobb, Matt Moore. We've got, you name it, we've got them. We're hoping Kevin Cash will come this year. We're waiting to hear from him when he arrives. But there'll be a lot of current Rays players that will be here, as well as former greats from all the different teams. So fans can get a great night of free autographs. We have a silent auction. We have a great dinner. And then the best part, we don't have any long-winded speeches, so people that are afraid to go to a banquet where there's going to be, it's a fun night. The players get up that are being inducted. They tell stories from the past. And I can't tell you, it's without question, I go all around the country to different events. It's the best event, I think, in baseball. And I think anybody that comes out, that's why they keep coming back and getting larger every year, because we show them a good time.
How do you go about choosing who your inductees are? Because it's been interesting to see the great crop that you bring each year.
Well, there's a couple of ways that we do it. And of course, one is Ted's secret formula, and we can't tell you what that is, but that's usually for at least one or two of the Hitter Hall of Fame folks that are being inducted. But people have to remember, we're not only the Hitters Hall of Fame, we're the Ted Williams Museum. So we have awards for people that have made a huge impact on the game, like Gene Michael. I mean, Gene Michael, maybe the average guy doesn't know him as well as Derek Jeter or Mickey Mantle, but Gene Michael had a tremendous effect on this game. And so he gets the Lifetime Achievement Award. We also have a pitching wall of great achievement. And this year we have Jim Catt, who had 16 gold gloves, and Denny McClain, the only player in history to win 31 games, are going on our wall of great achievement in the theater room, which is really, it's there to honor all the great pitchers in Major League Baseball. So we have all these different types of awards where people can come, and maybe you don't make the Hall of Fame, but if you're a Dale Murphy, which we had here a few years ago, and you had a huge impact on baseball, we have a place for you in the Ted Williams Museum and Hitters Hall of Fame.
And for our fans who have come to Tropicana Field, maybe didn't see it, you guys have kind of altered your location a little bit. You're on the second floor, right?
That's correct. As soon as you come in the main rotunda, gate one, if you come right up the stairs, you can walk right into the main entrance of the museum. And we just changed out over 40 cases. The first thing you'll hit is the top 10 that Ted picked, starting all the way back to Babe Ruth. And then we get into the modern players. We have great displays like the women in baseball, Japanese tribute case. We even have a Derek Jeter farewell case. And, of course, my favorite, the Don Zimmer Lifetime Achievement Award case that shows Don as a young Brooklyn Dodger and all the different teams that he worked with and all the lives that he touched. So all of that is here, including a whole wing dedicated to the Tampa Bay Rays. And finally, we have a Negro League section honoring those players back in those days that didn't get the chance to play in Major League Baseball. We have a whole section on that with Jackie Robinson and Satchel Paige. So there's something here for everyone.
Really is one of the hidden treasures of Tropicana Field. Dave McCarthy, best of luck with the dinner on the 31st. We'll see you there.
Thank you very much. Look forward to it, Neil.
That's Dave McCarthy on our Community Corner segment. To attend the dinner at Tropicana Field on January 31st, go to TedWilliamsMuseum.com, click on the Alex and Friends logo, and then purchase your tickets. Now, the final month of 2014 was awful hectic, too. It involved an 11-player trade, and the Rays coaching staff was resolved. Well, we continue our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast, and we get to formally congratulate one of the newest members of the Rays coaching staff. He has been with the Rays since they began, and that's Charlie Montoya, now the third base coach of the Rays. Charlie, thanks very much for being with us. Congratulations. Obviously, I know this was a thrill for you. Where were you when you got the news, and what do you remember most about the call?
Well, first of all, Neil, thank you very much for your kind words. And I was at the mall talking on the phone to Joe Bench when I got the call. I called from Florida, and I told Joe, I'm going to have to answer this call. Let's see who it is. And it was Kevin Cash. And, man, he was just great. He told me that he wanted me to be his third base coach. And, you know, he was really nice, and he made me feel great. And it was just a great call.
I know as a manager how much you enjoy telling guys they were going to the big leagues. How strange was it to be on the other side and being, in essence, called up to the big leagues now as a coach?
Well, I'll tell you what. Anytime somebody tells you you're going to the big leagues, it's exciting as a player and it's very exciting as a coach.
I know it had to be exciting for you, too, for your family, because you have worked nearly two decades as a coach to get to this point. What's it been like, you know, going through Christmas and the new year and the excitement back at home in Arizona?
Well, you know, it was really great. Just, you know, of course, telling my wife and then, of course, telling my dad, you know, because even though we're getting older, we're still kids for our parents. And he was very excited. My mom was very excited. And my dad jumped in the car, put his Rays uniform on, and he went to town and told everybody. So that was fun. And of course, all the many messages I've gotten from ex-players, you know, coaches and friends, it's been great.
Were there any messages that stick out? Anything special that you heard from any ex-player that is really memorable or really meant a lot to you?
You know, all of them, from all the ex-players, for sure, all the guys that played for me, they were pretty cool. You know, I got one from Bill Lipsy. That was really nice, you know, because Bill, one of my first bosses when we first came in with the Rays. But all of them, they were all pretty cool.
What about your two kids? I'm sure they had to be awful excited.
Yeah, I mean, that's a funny thing. The first thing that Alex said when he found out, he said, well, no more rainouts, you know, because he knows we're going to be indoors. So that was funny.
What does it mean to you that the Rays gave you this chance? Because you have been such a loyal employee all the way through and been with this team since they started.
That's what makes it even more special, because, you know, it's awesome, because I've been a Ray my whole coaching career, and now to be a big league coach with the same team, it's awesome, and it's I'm very humbled by it and excited.
Again, we're chatting with Charlie Montoya on our This Week in Rays Baseball podcast. Charlie, you know, you certainly, I'm sure this is one of the best memories you've had since becoming a member of the organization, but you also had many great teams and players over the years. At the minor league level, what are your best memories going to be with the Rays organization?
Well, of course, you know, winning the championships and stuff, they're awesome. But to me, the best ones are just telling guys, when I was at AAA, telling guys that they were going to the big leagues. It's just great to see their faces. That was my special moments, my favorite moments in the minor leagues.
I know you mentioned the call you got initially from Kevin Cash and what that was like. You've talked with him since. How good have the conversations been, and what are your impressions? I know you saw him plenty as a player in the International League at the AAA level.
You know, he was great when he first called me, and he has been great after. He has been great after that. He, you know, I was excited before I talked to him, and I'm more excited now after I talked to him. He's going to be great. He's going to do a great job, and I'm looking forward to work with him. He has been great.
Now, I know your main responsibility is going to be as third base coach, and Tom Foley, who's now the bench coach, was the third base coach. Does it help you to get to know the big leagues and the outfielders and who throws well and who doesn't to have him there?
You know, I am very lucky. My first year coaching third base, I'm going to have Tom Foley as the bench coach because he was probably the longest tenured third base coach in the big leagues. Were there for a long time, so yeah, of course I'm going to pick his brain, and he was one of the best, and I'm very happy that he's going to be the bench coach. And before I go to coach third base, you know, whatever situation, I'm going to ask him, you know, about the arms and so on. So yeah, I'm very happy and lucky that I'm going to have Foley there.
Give our fans an idea what else you'll be doing. What are your other responsibilities going to be with the Rays? Because I'm sure for every third base coach at the big league level, it's a little bit different.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be working with everybody. I mean, I'm going to help Foley with the infielders. I'm going to help Rocco with the outfielders. You know, and I'm going to help in the cage. So I'm going to be wherever they need me.
Well, a utility guy is a good thing to be, especially in this organization. And we look forward to seeing you in spring training. Again, hearty congratulations from everyone at the Rays radio team and broadcast team. And we look forward to seeing you in Port Charlotte.
Same here, Neil. Thank you very much.
That's Charlie Montoyo, now third base coach for the Tampa Bay Rays. This week, the Rays host the organization's Winter Development Program, and we'll have details on that and much more in our next podcast at the end of this week. Don't forget to continue to follow our blog, raysradio.mlblogs.com, and on Twitter, we're at Rays Radio. Thanks for joining us, and we'll speak with you soon.
Thank you for listening to the This Week in Rays Baseball podcast. For more on the Rays this offseason, visit our blog at raysradio.mlblogs.com and follow us on Twitter at Rays Radio.